Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth.
Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. In this episode, we'll feature an interview with Chicago performer and author Jeff Phillips about his new dystopian novella entitled Turbantan. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, here's the weekly program of Media and Democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
2 centuries after the founders wrote about the necessity of a free press for the survival of a democratic republic, the American news media appear to be in trouble. As newsrooms and foreign bureaus shrink and disappear, the debate about the crisis in journalism has shifted from a blame game to generating ideas for ensuring the survival of investigative reporting. Professor Robert W. McChesney and journalist John Nichols have been vocal participants in this debate. They've written a new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism. An excerpt is in the latest issue of The Nation magazine, which clears up long-held misconceptions about the production of news and discusses new ideas for a vibrant American media that supports good journalism.
McChesney, who teaches at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, is the author of numerous books on media and politics and is the co-founder of Free Press. He says that the 100-year-old idea of getting journalism from newspapers that serve as profit-maximizing vehicles fueled by advertising has run its course.
One of the great misconceptions that really damages our ability to grasp the crisis of journalism and what to do about it is the belief that it's naturally a free market function set up to maximize profit based on getting revenues from advertising. In fact, this model is a relatively recent historical development. Advertising came to play the dominant role providing revenues to bankroll journalism in the late 19th century and has done so for a century. But now that model has ended. And we have to look at the fact that that wasn't really the rule of thumb. That was the exception to the rule. Before advertising had emerged to take over the sponsorship of journalism, it had been a heavily subsidized matter by the federal government through postal and printing subsidies, because they understood, the founders did, and the Congresses and the government's first 100 years of the United States, that unless there were massive public subsidies, the public good that is journalism wouldn't have been produced sufficiently by the market, nowhere near sufficient.
That's the moment we're in now, McChesney says, the realization that if the existing market is not producing good journalism, we need to look elsewhere, starting by looking at our own history, for ways to subsidize the news we need.
In the first several generations of the Republic, the federal government instituted massive postal subsidies, and this was crucial because almost all newspapers and magazines were distributed by the mails. That was the distribution system of America's free press, and the subsidies were extraordinary. To send a newspaper cost just a small pittance during this period. You know, the big debate in Congress throughout this period was whether to have a very small charge for newspapers or let them all be sent for free.
At the time, subsidies for news actually accounted for a large part of the federal budget.
By our calculation, if you took the same percentage of gross domestic product today and dedicated it to journalism subsidies as the government of the United States did in the first half of the 19th century, it would be approximately $30 billion, $30 billion subsidy. That's how crucial supporting a free press was to the American government prior to the late 19th century.
Government spending for subsidizing a free press was only second to military spending back then, McChesney says. Yet today, we spend only $400 million in public funds for all of public broadcasting, not just journalism. That's a mere pittance compared to other countries in Western Europe and Asia. These countries heavily subsidize their public broadcasting systems and their newspapers.
What the record shows us from Western Europe is that these countries also are regarded as strongest democracies, the least amount of government corruption, the most amount of public involvement in political life. They also, by the calculations of Freedom House, which is a very pro-private, pro-commercial media organization, have the least amount of government harassment of private commercial media.
McChesney argues that, although successful commercial media models are welcome, we need public subsidies as the foundation of a strong, independent, nonprofit, non-commercial media.
So in the short term, in the crisis phase, the most important thing we need to do is really heavily bankroll our existing public and community stations to have them ramp up their journalism, particularly at the local level. Down the road, we have to think about ways and policies to get young people back into journalism. We're losing an entire generation. And we have to ultimately think about ways of creatively funding digital news operations that haven't even been begun yet, that we can't even imagine. So they have the resources to do the job, and they don't have to beg for micropayments and advertising, but they can do the job of journalism.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The attempted reincarnation of former Tennessee Congressman Harold Ford Jr. as a senator from New York demonstrates that, in the United States, money is the only meaningful political constituency. Money chooses its representatives based on who can most reliably serve the interests of the moneyed classes, and it matters little which actual human constituency or geographic jurisdiction the chosen politician purports to represent. Memphis or Manhattan, what's the difference when the only audience that counts is big capital? In the United States, the corporate boardroom is the equivalent of Hollywood's casting couch. It is where the political actor auditions for a starring role as a servant to the ruling class. In 21st century America, it is considered a great sign of progress that black actors can now lie down on the corporate casting couch to vie for top billing in the multi-billion dollar theatrical venues of electoral politics. All that was required for Harold Ford to become an instantly viable candidate for a U.S. Senate seat from New York was the backing of three billionaires, including Michael Bloomberg, the seventh most wealthy man in the nation, who bought his own job of mayor of New York City three times and now wants to buy his very own senator. By the corrupt rules of U.S. political theater, Harold Ford has earned the part. He was a trailblazer in right-wing black Democratic politics, having paved the way for Barack Obama by aggressively wooing corporations and Republicans to the detriment of his poor and working-class constituents in Memphis, Tennessee. Ford was a black blue dog Democrat years before Obama forged similar alliances on the national stage. Congressman Harold Ford was kissing George Bush's Republican behind long before Obama invited key Bush appointees into his new administration. Harold Ford joined with George Bush in an assault on Social Security years before Barack Obama put all federal entitlements on the chopping block. And although Ford was one of only four black lawmakers to vote in favor of authorizing Bush to invade Iraq, while Obama was telling Illinois voters he opposed the war, Obama has since expanded America's wars in ways that should make Bush and Harold Ford proud. Harold Ford was an early black recruit to the Democratic Leadership Council, the corporate headquarters in the Democratic Party, and now serves as the DLC's chairman. Barack Obama always acted like a member of the DLC and finally admitted he was their ideological soulmate 2 months into his presidency. So, although the Obama White House has been lobbying against Harold Ford's senatorial candidacy, it's not because of any political differences between the two right-wing corporate Democrats. Maybe the problem is they're too much alike, and Obama thinks there's only room for one of him on the national stage. But that may be too bad, because Harold Ford has his three billionaires, and that's all it takes to make a political comeback in the U.S. of A. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchik. We now feature an interview with Chicago performer and author Jeff Phillips about his new dystopian novella entitled Turbantan. The following interview was recorded on Friday, January 8th, 2010. We are joined by Jeff Phillips. Jeff Phillips is a Chicago author, performer, and author. He is the author of the novellas Turbantan and Whiskey Pike, and he is joining us for the show. Hi. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'd like to focus our discussion on your book Turbantan. For the benefit of listeners who may be unfamiliar with the book, tell us a little bit about what the book is about.
Well, it follows the story of the Drippy Man. It takes place in a very, I like to describe it as pre-apocalyptic world. It's sort of reaching a sort of critical mass, so to speak. Kind of dystopian fantasy. And it follows this character, the Drippy Man, in he's a secret agent in the future. It takes place in 2032. And it's reached a point where the government has reached a massive debt, and it gets to a point sort of playing off with what's going on in the economy and mm-hmm. the world today, and it gets to a point where somebody rich enough comes by and just buys out the government, and the government's so in the hole that it's kind of forced to in this world, and from there it the government's just a business entity, and the Drippy Man is his function isn't necessarily as a secret agent to protect a nation. It's more so protecting an investment, and that's sort of where his adventures stem from. And it's I wrote it in a very coded way to sort of protect the identity of these supposed characters.
It would seem that you were kind of, my guess would be that you were writing this as a kind of tale about what's going on now regarding, well, it's not hard to see, regarding the economy, regarding increasing privatization of government, regarding various environmental calamities that could befall all of humanity, all these things.
Yeah.
What was your, was it all of these things that motivated you, or one in particular? Or
well,
tell us about your
things.
Motivation.
I think part of the motivation, the story began, I probably wrote a chunk of it maybe 2 years ago. I just sort of had this idea of this, starting out with this secret agent on vacation, and sort of he's unable to release, he's been so consumed by this occupation. It is every function who he is. He can't even sit down on the beach and not think about it. And it's stuff that I've experienced with some of my jobs where you get to a point with responsibilities and you can't stop thinking about it, and you dream about it, and I sort of wanted to fixate it on this moment where he's realizing he's got this tan line that he neglected to see before, and he starts thinking about how he hasn't fully immersed himself and how he let himself and his job down. It sort of began from there, and sort of, and it was just kind of the scene on the beach, and then it started from that, it kind of percolated some ideas on what kind of world this extends from there, and I started trying to thinking about the future, and then looking at the world of economics, and I don't really know that much about economics. I didn't know much about it when I first wanted to write the book, and I wanted to learn more about it, and I've tried to read more about it, and it's still a very complex game, and I can't claim to be any sort of expert on it, but more so I wanted to explore that world.
Did you find that the exercise of writing the book helped you in your self-teachings for economics or whatever?
Yeah, I feel like it actually gave me more questions than any sort of answers, but I guess that's a good thing. You know, it sets you off in the direction of continuing an exploration. And too, I got very, for a while, I got really into these movies called Zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen,
yeah.
And just a lot of the sort of theories that are going on there kind of tripped my imagination and got me running with, you know, what is really going on and sort of the whole structure of the economic system and where that could lead us sort of got me.
And especially where there are parallels that you would find today, just to mention one example, they're talking about some guy just swooping in, a venture capitalist of the future, coming in and having enough money to buy out the government.
Right.
And yet, I remember reading a statistic this week regarding the privatization of our own, the Pentagon, for example, U.S. Department of Defense. It turns out that the privatization levels are now, by the end of the year, I think it's going to come up to something like 220,000 private contractors that would be involved in Iraq. That would actually outnumber the number of U.S. troops that would be in Iraq.
Yeah.
Where before it had been like a 1-to-1 ratio, it's now going to be like probably 3-to-1 contractors to government representatives, soldiers, or what have you. And so it seems like that while this novel depicts it as a kind of more dramatic fashion, it's just some super venture capitalist just comes in and buys it all up in some backroom deal. You're finding the kind of thing happening now, although kind of subtly and not all that well known or talked about, but it's there, and that's happening.
In fact, I think I heard something on the news earlier this week. I was listening to it when I woke up on NPR, but I feel like I heard something along the lines of in California, the privatization of prisons, which wouldn't surprise me. And it's actually a really scary thought. You know, I mean, what kind of laws preside in that sort of situation when it's a privately run base of captivity?
Since this book is published, have you found that it's helped you connect not just so much with learning about what's going on or trying to get a hold of that, but do you also find that you're connecting with other people who are also exploring similar questions?
Yeah.
Especially using the genre of fiction?
Yeah, I sent it to a friend of mine, Aaron Sinek, who's
I know him.
Yeah. He,
small world.
He got really excited about it because he's working on something similar, sort of dystopian zine, and then we're collaborating, we're trying to get a reading together and shooting for mid-February.
Yeah, 2009. Yeah. Or 2010.
Yeah. So that's really exciting to sort of get this dystopian theme. We're trying to bring in some other writers and see what they come up with and just sort of get an event going and sort of share opinions and ideas and scare each other, I guess, of the future.
Where do you think... you would hope that something like this would be a cautionary tale. Obviously, you're not a fan of, or at least I gather from the conversation we're having, that you're not a fan of, you know, this kind of privatization or neoliberalism or all of these trends that you discuss in the book and allude to. But nonetheless, the hope is that a book like this would serve as a cautionary tale. Look at what would happen if we don't do something about it now.
Right.
So therefore, this is supposed to motivate you to do something about it.
Yeah.
Does that animate you? Have you found that people who are reading the book are getting more involved? What's your take there?
I haven't really seen it change people's actions yet. I mean, it's pretty new. It came out just before Christmas time, so it's still in the process of getting it out there and getting people to read it. And it, you know, and it's interesting too, seeing that some people read it and found it very funny. And it wasn't necessarily the intention to be funny, but I guess there's sort of a, you know, and I feel like maybe in some way I've sort of satirized the genre of dystopia, and it's sort of, there's some comic undercutting that I throw in there with the, you know, you have this sort of antiquated old Boston home, but then you throw in some grilled cheese sandwiches and, you know, just sort of, you know, playing with those kind of weird contrasts. You know, and it might be something that might take some time to seep into to somebody's conscience. You know, and I feel like a lot of literature probably works that way, where you read it, you know, there's something exciting about it, you sink into the story, and then, you know, it sinks into your subconscious over time, and certain ideas come back at you when you least expect it.
I took part in the conference last year in Chicago called Think Galacticon that was focused on science fiction and kind of critical politics, and it can include themes like government authoritarianism and the environment and feminism and lots of various political strands to discuss how they're kind of connected or could be expressed by the genre very writ large of science fiction.
Right.
One thing I found out about, and this is what I wanted to discuss with you about, is that the kind of, if you wanted to get some sci-fi ideas out, one typical way of doing it is write a novel about it.
Yeah.
Except that even in the most quick circumstances, that's still a proposition that would take a lot of time, especially where, given the state of current affairs that you're trying to address, things are happening so quickly that it's kind of hard to write a book and then, like, if you come up with an idea, you spend a year writing a book, and then you try to get it published, and then the publisher finally find a publisher who publishes it, then that's like another year before it finally gets published. That could be two, maybe three, maybe more years before you go from original idea to finally getting it out there.
Right.
So you've got, and meanwhile, the world has changed Lord knows how many times in those two intervening 2 or 3 years, right, especially these days.
Yeah.
Now, one way that you've, and I found that lots of people are trying to address this in different ways. One example that came to mind is a gentleman, Cory Doctorow, who wrote a book called Little Brother, the kind of science fiction cautionary tale, but not so sci-fi, more like a political tale, where he actually published it for the most part online and just published it as a series of chapters in PDF format, posting it online and making it available in a staggering variety of formats. You've seemed to have taken a different tack where you're not quite self-publishing a book, but started your own publishing operation.
Yeah. I sort of call the operation the Eagle Oven Publishing Project.
Okay.
Not necessarily in the works of creating a whole company, because it's sort of hard to start that business, keep that business going. It's a whole thing.
So definitely.
I went through this service called CreateSpace.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subsidiary of Amazon.com, and it works off the print-on-demand model.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, being the author, setting up the account, I get very discounted rates. So I'm able to get a lot of books printed up in the physical form, but it's also really easily available online. Somebody orders it. I think I did a test run, and the cheapest shipping, it came within like 3 to 4 days.
Mm.
So they're really easy to work with, and you have a lot of control over it. You upload your PDF the way you want it to look. You specify the trim size. You upload your design, your own cover, and it's all on you, which is great. You know, you have the control, and it's also, whereas a lot of kind of self-publishing companies, they try and get you. You know, they kind of prey off the fact that most authors, first-time authors, don't really know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was almost about to shell out a couple thousand, thinking that I need this publishing consultant. You know, and a few bookmarks thrown in there, or whatever. But CreateSpace was very, very affordable and very fast moving, and it was great to be able to ride the adrenaline of putting out this piece. And
what was the timetable from where you first started the book to when you finally had a physical copy in your hand?
The from the beginning of the writing process.
Yeah, from the beginning, like where you first got the idea. I want to write this, and you sit down. How long did that take?
For the novella form, it was probably over the summer where I took this shorter piece that it wasn't even really a short story, not even really a poem. It was kind of a combination, more so a scene. I wrote a short scene and came across it, and it kind of got excited, triggered some new ideas, and I wrote another scene, kind of the beginning part with the drippy man and his dry advisor, kind of outlining their relationship. Where the elder advisor fellow is sort of seeing where the world's going versus when he was younger, and sort of trying to warn the drippy man. It's almost like the drippy man is so set in his ways, and then it's sort of, you know, get another idea for another scene, you know, and sort of an idea for another part of that world. And it was, I basically had a scene written up until October, and then October was kind of the fury of unleashing all these ideas that kind of stewed. And then by the end of October, I had the first draft done, and just set to work on revising it, and got some good friends to help out the the revision process. And my good buddy James M. Keenitz Wilkins, he's a filmmaker in New York. My friend Ian Randall, he's a writer in Chicago, and my friend Morgan Carr, they're really helpful in sort of helping me go line by line, combing through it. And end of November, then I had it, the final manuscript ready to go, and it was probably ready in print. 15th, maybe.
Of December.
December. Yeah, so middle of the month, December.
Still an impressive turnaround.
Yeah, it came together pretty quickly, and we definitely put a lot of time into it, but it did sort of, just come together pretty quickly.
What are your expectations and hopes for the book? In the most optimistic scenario of, yes, I deem this a success, what are your hopes, what would your hopes be for a successful book?
I'd like for widespread readership and sort of for the ideas to get people to at the very least start asking more questions, I'm not expecting it to somebody reads it and then they're gonna jump into politics and change the course of things, but at least to start seeing maybe how can I avoid this type of situation, what can I do, what really is going on in the government, because politics is always filled with points of view and opinions, and it's hard to tell the absolute reality. So at least I'd like to incite the quest to find that absolute reality. For people to start cutting through what the facade of the news might be and what is really going on, where might things really might actually head, even if it is what seems like a far-fetched scenario. Far-fetched things do happen.
Yeah, and sometimes, kind of like in physics, it's not that so much that you have crazy ideas, is are they crazy enough?
Yeah.
And a lot of times, they're not.
Right, yeah.
What do you think to be the craziest idea or the one most notable thing about the book that you'd like to, that you consider to have been that which you're glad you wrote the book for?
Let's see. I'm really glad that I, from a microcosm perspective, I'm really glad I sort of tackled the idea of jobs and certain occupations sort of taking over someone's way of thinking. Mm. Like it sort of happens with the drippy man's evolution. I mean, he sees this, he has this opportunity to avoid a certain fate, but because he's so kind of chemically taken over by this job, he ends up going back into it. It's just something you sort of see with a lot of people this day and age, where it's almost like that sort of chemical commitment to this occupation, where it takes over every sort of living thought. You dream about it every night, and it might seem harmless, like, oh, it's just, work a lot, it's another work dream, but it almost breeds a certain apathy, where because you're so in that world, you don't really pay attention to what is going on larger levels, even smaller levels, in your more immediate community, and then the larger global community.
Going back to more mundane details about the book, is this available in bookstores now? Or how, if I wanted to order it, how can I do so?
Best way, if you go to turbantan.com, it's all one word, turbantan.com, you can order it right from there. It's directly set up at the printer. It's also on amazon.com, if you just search the title, Turban Tan.
And you're getting your own ISBN number, I think.
Yeah. It's got an ISBN number. And right now, it's also available at Quimby's Bookstore here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And this coming week, I got some meetings set up with different other bookstores, and they, independent bookstores in the area. I'm gonna...
Have you, it might be a little too soon to tell, but have you made an attempt to try to crack this book into like the, you know, the chain bookstores, the Borders, the Barnes and Nobles, or you...
I'd like to. I think with the Crate Space service, it's very shortly here, it should be in the Books in Print Index, which means like the Borders and Barnes and Noble, it will be, they'll have the information to order it. So like if you go into the, it probably won't be widespread in those bookstores right off the bat, but if you go into like a Borders and ask one of the clerks if you got Turbintan, and they'll look it up and, oh, but we can order it for you. So hopefully very soon. I think they said about like a 6-week turnaround time for that from the publishing. So
is there anything else about the book that you wanted to say that I haven't asked you about yet in the couple minutes we have remaining?
Let's see. I guess I'm really... I was very interested to explore the Dubai world in there. The Middle East, kind of bring the Middle East into the world that the Drippy Man is navigating. And it's interesting, too, the developments that continue to happen in Dubai. And, you know, I'm sort of excited to explore that. Something fascinating about this city. Can't quite put my finger on exactly what, but it's, you know, I mean, that now it's got the world's tallest skyscraper, which is...
As we're recording this week, it opened.
Yeah, and it's interesting pictures of that. Just pales every... And they got some tall buildings out there, too.
Mm.
Just pales everything. Yeah.
Very cool. We've been speaking with Jeff Phillips. He is a Chicago actor, performer, and author. He's written two novellas, Turbintan, which we've been talking about on the show, and Whiskey Pike. And you can order a copy of the book at turbintan.com. And Jeff, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
That was an interview with Jeff Phillips, recorded on January 8th, 2010.
Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.